Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Natalia Shpulova-Said. I'm a host of New Books in Ukrainian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today I'm speaking with Serhiy Zhuk, author of KGB Operations Against the USA and Canada in Soviet Ukraine, 1953-1991, published by Routledge in 2022. Dr. Zhuk has taught American history, Russian, Soviet, and Ukrainian history at Ball State University, the University of Pennsylvania, Johns Hopkins University, and Columbia University. His research interests are international relations, knowledge production, cultural consumption, religion, popular culture, and identity in the history of Imperial Russia, Ukraine, and the Soviet Union. Dr. Zhuk's scholarship was awarded with numerous research grants, including Cannon Institute at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, Fulbright, Petroyatsik, and Timkiv Ukrainian Studies grants from the University of Toronto, and Harriman Institute, Columbia University. Just recently, he was invited as a Fulbright scholar to teach in 2022 in Estonia. His published books include Soviet Americana, The Cultural History of Russian and Ukrainian Americanists, Nikolai Balhabitinov and American Studies in the USSR, People's Diplomacy in the Cold War, to name but a few. Hello, Sergei, and thank you so much for joining me today. Congratulations on your new book.
Thank you for inviting.
So let me start with a quote from your book. All KGB operations against the United States and Canada were influenced directly by Stalin's politics during and immediately after the Great Patriotic War, noted one retired KGB officer. How to deal with the displaced people, many of whom were residents of Soviet Ukraine in Europe. How to trace and punish the Nazi collaborators and war criminals, he continued. These were major problems for Stalin's administration, which became his legacy for the organs KGB work through the entire 1950s. So could you provide some background for the book that covers the 1953-1991 years with a special focus on the KGB operations against Canada and the US and Soviet Ukraine?
We need to understand that entire politics of KGB was shaped by Stalin's policy, by beginning of the Cold War with the United States. And for Stalin and his comrades, United States was major adversary, but because for his concept of building Ukraine as a bastion, as a fortress, fighting American, British, other imperialism, Ukraine became very important. And besides United States, of course, other places where Ukrainian diaspora, Ukrainian refugees lived, became very important for his concept of strengthening Ukrainian socialist fortress in the struggle. And these countries were United States, major adversary of Soviet Union, Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And again, Stalin knew that more than 50% of Canadian communists were Ukrainians, people of Ukrainian origin. So that's for him was very important signifier as well. And plus Britain, because many refugees went to Britain. And as a result, because in his concept, these Ukrainian nationalists, many of them collaborated with Nazi, were major enemies for his this concept of strong Ukrainian socialist fortress on western borders of the Soviet Union. Because of this, he started all these, you know, operations against Ukrainian diaspora. And that's why I began my conversation with this phrase, because we've forgotten sometimes, especially during perestroika, during the post-Soviet developments, that KGB was a creation of Stalinism, even with different name, OGPU, NKVD, whatever. It was major secret organization, secret army for political organization known as Communist Party of the Soviet Union. And this very important what we need to understand, because sometimes Western scholars try to westernize this notion of KGB as mostly, you know, well, analyzing elements of intelligence, spying, but still, we need to know this phrase, активные мероприятия, active measures. And these phrases were part of this ideology, KGB ideology. It was not just spying, but also organizing covert operations to divide enemy, to discredit enemy, to use enemy to influence enemies through disinformation or bad information. This was major methods or strategy of this organization. Again, all these methods of active measures were reflection of major ideology of Soviet communism fighting American imperialism on international arena. So this is a major premise of my book, because this will affect not only international politics, but also domestic politics of the Soviet Union. They were fighting KGB as army of Communist Party. Mm-hmm. This organization was fighting its enemy on two fronts, domestic front and international, and they were connected. That's why my major emphasis in this book was on connection of these two fronts. And documents which I started to read in Kyiv actually gave me plenty of material about this connection. That's why it's my first attempt to cover these documents, had this title, KGB Operations in Soviet Ukraine, mm-hmm. the domestic, but targeting two major enemies of socialist Ukrainian project of Stalin.
Mm-hmm. I would like to go back for a moment to this notion of KGB operations or active measures. And mm-hmm. you quote Seth Jones, who says, "During the Cold War, the Soviet Union developed a broad campaign to influence populations across the globe, which was best captured in the phrase active measures. And there is also a quote from Olga Bertelsen, who explains the dimensions, with, these two dimensions that you mentioned in her explanation of active measures. They, active measures, had two dimensions, domestic and foreign. Their task was to enforce and reinforce a Soviet version of the story, a discourse, a rhetoric, and rhetoric across geographical and political lines. During the Cold War, the stability and omnipresence of the Czechist narrative and discourse guaranteed change in public opinion, and this change had to be universal. The prevalence of this discourse ultimately suppressed and marginalized other voices, truths, and discourses that were inadmissible for the Soviet regime, end of quote.
Well, we sometimes forget that the Soviet Union was an ideological project. It's, again, ideology played a very important role in the West, of course, in the United States, but never in the world, probably except fascist regimes in Germany, in Italy, this totalitarian ideological model of Soviet Union had major framework to fight. And that's why people in the West sometimes couldn't understand the essence of active measures, mm-hmm. essence of any operation. You know, we sometimes tend to divide активные мероприятия, active measures, and spying operation, intelligence operation. But in everyday life of KGB operatives, KGB age, KGB officer, they were mixed together because major goal was ideological goal to present positive picture of Soviet reality, of Soviet politics. If it's major ideological project, it means that you could involve any ideological institution and venue in countries of major adversary, media, press, television, radio, political debates, political organizations of any sort, leftist groups, peace movement and peace organization. And the most important venue was, of course, centers of studies, especially studies which were controversial from ideological point of view. I mean, centers of Ukrainian studies. For example, when in 1968, Harvard Ukrainian Research Institute was created, KGB immediately attacked this effort. They tried to collect information about Emelyan Pritsak. They did the same with Columbia University when they tried to create Center of Ukrainian Studies. And with Toronto, they not only tried to monitor these centers because they were important from ideological point of view. You know, they hated all non-socialist interpretation of Ukraine reality. That's why centers like Harvard Center or Toronto Center were dangerous for ideological framework of Soviet Ukraine. So they try to discredit these centers, finding collaboration with Nazi or collaboration with CIA and American or Canadian intelligence. But at the same time, they try to figure out how to influence these people, because these people needed sometimes access to Ukrainian archives, Ukrainian libraries, Ukrainian sources, and they use these connections to blackmail or to control these people. Plus, they started infiltration of young graduate students from Canada, from United Kingdom, from United States, even from developing countries who happened to be in Kyiv, and they used these students and these people to infiltrate these organizations. Again, why? Because KGB was an ideological organization. That's why they did care about how the West presented the images of Ukraine or images of enemies of Ukraine. For example, they used archival documents about collaboration of Ukrainians who fled from Ukraine to the West. And they provide even video material to discredit Ukraine diaspora as fascist, nationalistic, anti-Semitic groups. In this case, they again used ideology to pursue one goal, to divide opponents of Soviet socialism in Ukraine, and major opponents were Ukrainian nationalists and Jewish nationalists. And if they have these facts about how Ukrainians killed Jews, and they present these facts in Canadian and American media, it was to discredit these organizations and to use each other for this. But again, it's just one example of how ideology played very important role in KGB operation. That's why for us, especially people who try to use Western approaches, it's very difficult to tell where active measures started or espionage started, because they were sometimes connected, and sometimes it was related directly to terrorist acts. You forgot that the KGB still killed people. And you remember Serzhiy Plakhy's book about Starshinsky case. It's a very famous case, but he beautifully wrote this book about killing Bandera in 1959. This was only one case among many. Again, what is this? It's terrorist organization, terrorist operation, active measures operation, or special operation of KGB to create some ideological moment, because they need to remove, for example, Bandera from this historical event. Bandera lost control of his organization in Germany, but for ideological standpoint, it was very important to remove him and replace radical Bender-White section with more moderate so-called Melnik section. The same with ideology of Ukrainian studies in the West. KGB supported more moderate studies of Emelyan Pritsak or other people who tried to be friendly with Soviet Union, rather than views of more radical Ukrainian scholars. So, probably I finish.
So, and in your book, you also say that the goal of the KGB activities was to undermine the unity of Ukrainian immigrant groups. And as you mentioned, there were a lot of measures which were undertaken to complete this goal, but would you probably focus on some that were completed and which would be regarded successful by the KGB?
Well, many of them. First, it's using communists in both United States and Canada, especially leftist and communist Ukrainians. The most important and famous or infamous case is Kravchuk case. They used Ukrainian Canadian communist Kravchuk, who from 1946 collaborated with KGB, and they used people like Kravchuk, bribing them, of course, giving them money, supporting their businesses. A lot of leftist businesses in Canada were on KGB payroll. You forgot about this. helping their children to get admission to Kyiv University and so on. And Petro Kravchuk and other people were used even against those communists who tried to criticize Russification in Ukraine, for example. I describe in one chapter, it's one of the best chapters of my book, this operation, KGB operation, when they used Kravchuk against Kolyaska, Ivan Kolyaska, who publicly criticized being 100% communist, student of higher party school in Kyiv, who publicly criticized Russification of Soviet Ukraine. And eventually KGB succeeded. They actually destroyed this radical anti-Russian opposition in Communist Party of Canada. Another example of their success, it's their operations against so-called spy schools in West Germany when they used to divide Russian nationalists who hated Ukrainians and Ukrainian nationalists who hated Russians. And they used this Russian imperial Russian nationalism against Ukrainian nationalism, trying to recruit these guys, making them double agents. Frankly speaking, all CIA operations which were used Ukrainian nationalists, Ukrainian agents from these spy schools of 40s and 50s failed completely. And another success of KGB was how they used to recruit professors from these teachers from these schools. In my book, I just gave three examples, but the most crucial examples, major leaders of these spy schools who collaborated with Nazis during the war, who fled from Soviet Ukraine after the war, who became teachers of these spy schools in Bavaria and Regensburg and other places in Germany, who were funded by CIA and other British and American intelligence, became double agents. And of course, they gave all these, I put even pictures of those agents of Ukrainian origins who were former refugees, Ostarbeiters, some of them, not all of them, Benderwhites, who collaborated with Nazis, no, who were probably prisoners of war, you know, soldiers of Soviet Army, Red Army. They stayed in Germany. So all these people eventually were recruited by these schools. They became CIA agents. All of them failed. All of them were arrested or, you know, they became double agents. But no one succeeded. And this is another example of how KGB used to divide these pro-Russian or pro-Ukrainian people in these schools. Or they used actually a very interesting model of seductive America. Actually, it was my first title for this book. So they understood that these teachers in CIA schools and this American spy schools were frustrated with situation in Germany, with their life, and they loved America. So what KGB agents did, they presented, again, ideological aspect which we discussed at the beginning, they presented this image of Khrushchev, Ukraine, as Americanized Ukraine. Look, Ukraine now listen to American jazz. They have Stiliagi. They have all these new ideas. Why you should criticize Soviet Union is not Stalin's Soviet Union. And many of these instructors of spy schools followed this game. Plus, they have relatives in Kyiv, in Dnipro, and other cities were used again. But it's for me, it was a revelation that CIA actually failed because of this very good ideological game. My major idea, probably I lost this in my book, that at the beginning, during the Civil War, the West and the CIA actually missed the role of ideology, this totalitarian control of mentality. Mm-hmm. And that's how, for example, today, the West still couldn't understand Russian mentality. Mm-hmm. Because Russian mentality, like Soviet mentality, mm-hmm. is product of brainwashing. It's not just one television show or public presentation of leader. No, it's entire lifestyle of Soviet people and entire style of Russian people today, when they have this massive total ideological control and ideological brainwashing in their cultural rituals, in their life, beginning with kindergarten and finishing with school, high school, and so on. The same, it's, again, what happened in Russia today, it's result of Soviet tradition. And the West, including CIA agents, could not understand this, because massive brainwashing of Soviet people and Soviet agents actually played a very important role in this opposition to CIA operations. Mm-hmm. And CIA failed. Mm-hmm. And I showed at the beginning of my book this failure in these so-called spy schools in Germany.
But along these lines, you also touch upon this paradoxical response of some KGB agents who would have business trips to the U.S. There is another quote in your book. According to contemporaries, all KGB people, after visiting America on the intelligence assignment, developed a psychological phenomenon which was known as a fondness of America and its people.
Yeah, it's another paradox which we've forgotten. And I think that if Putin would live not in Dresden, but went to to Stuttgart, to Hamburg, to better life, who knows what happened? Because Putin is an example of failed agent who never reached this imaginary West. He lived in socialist East, in Germany. Socialist Germany. But those guys who live in the West, not for one day, not for one week, for many years, developed this paradoxical love for America. Mm-hmm. They love the American products, they love American jeans, they love American cigarettes, whatever. And they maintain this image of positive image of America. It's not just in Kalugin memoirs, Kalugin general KGB memoirs, which I used for this quotation, but also many people who worked for KGB, like Slava Nikonov, grandchild of Molotov, who was one of the first participants of Fulbright program to visit United States. And I still remember how he described, I met him in Moscow in the 80s. Many of my music records came from him. So these guys actually developed this very strange attitude to the United States. I call this love-hate relations. And many of them actually try to even collaborate with Secret Service of the United States when it was appropriate. I described in 1972 this case of Nixon visit to Soviet Union, when the first time Soviet Secret Service and American Secret Service collaborated together. They provided classified information about dissidents, about people who tried to kill Nixon or Brezhnev, and they developed very good relations. It was, you know, like part of my book, it's revelation of about American civilization made by these KGB agents, because they discovered different civilization with cheap cars, with different kind of fashions, with openness. And many of them maintained this positive image despite all this ideological confrontation. They still maintain this positive image of America. They drank together in 1972. They exchanged information. They helped each other. But again, problem with these people, they were too ideologized by their ideological departments. So when try to develop these relations, this pressure from above, from the party, because they were, you know, special organization of the party, actually stop these relations. And eventually they finished with cases of espionage. And again, you need to understand another feature of my book, how this love-hate relations with America contribute to very good technological espionage, very effective. 80-90% of all so-called Soviet technological innovation, especially in computer technology, communication technology, was just basically stolen from Americans and brought to Kiev, to Moscow, to other centers. So, and again, this was also a result of this strange love-hate relations, which I described in my previous book, Soviet Americana. It's another paradox. And I still think that people in Moscow would take different position if they would live in America for 1 or 2 years. Not like Putin, who lived in socialist Germany, or Patrushev, who never lived in the United States. So what is missing in now in the Russian leadership, this nostalgia for imaginary American past, which would help these KGB officers who lead now in post-Soviet Russia. But I would add another very important thing, which we forgot. With all this comparison of post-Soviet intelligence service, FSB, and Soviet Ukraine, SBU, and other, we have very important difference. Before 1991, KGB was part of this ideological, political group in the party. With today developments, we have different KGB capitalism in Russia, with very different ideological developments, and with no party control. What was good about Khrushchev and Brezhnev period, they established control over KGB after Stalin. Now we're back to Stalin's time, but again, Stalin also had Politburo. Now in Russia, we had no such thing as limits and control or monitoring service of this organization, which did exist in Soviet Union.
One of the chapters, you also talk about all kinds of exhibitions which were attended by KGB agents, and you make this note that KGB agents would sometimes forget about their intelligence assignment, and they would just start taking notes in order to study foreign mentality. And it looks like, to some extent, they were probably intrigued, right, by meeting their other, and they were intrigued to study this different culture or other culture. How detailed, to what extent these notes were detailed, and whether these notes were helpful for understanding the West in this case, for understanding the United States and American culture?
Well, these documents had tremendous role. I never expected to read these very detailed reports. But for me, it was sure, you know, I decided to use these reports word by word for my book because it was like encyclopedia of Soviet interests about how Americans live, how Americans think or thought in those days. So for me, it was encyclopedia of Soviet-American relations from, you know, from position of ordinary Soviet person who happened to be an agent. For example, one of the best part of my book, it's description of these American exhibitions in Kyiv. I use the most detailed reports from 1964 American exhibition about communication. And what I found, it's tremendous interest in even in personal life, sexual relations with people. For example, KGB sometimes tried to use their agents to seduce, to make love to American girls, to American lady, to use in the future. And for many of these American, Soviet seducers, Soviet sexual agents, was a shock how these American girls behaved in different way from this traditional stereotype of Soviet, you know, man domineering practice. Eventually, these agents submitted all these details about dinner, about trips to museums, to restaurants, with detailed information how their partner behaved, how they reacted. I try to be very careful because sometimes these reports contain very graphic sexual details. But again, it showed just ordinary human curiosity because supervisors of these KGB officers did not redacted or removed these details. They underlined them. They read them. So not only I enjoy reading these very graphic details of seducing, seduction, interaction, but also KGB supervisors read and enjoyed reading all this. So for many of these KGB operatives, these operations against staff of American exhibitions was again revelation or open door to different civilization, different style. You know, many of these reports, for example, contained details about homosexual couple. You know, it's for Soviets of 1964, it was very difficult even to imagine these kinds of relations. Then people could understand how their agents could change their partners. So it's very interesting and very readable material. So that's why I put this in my book as well, to show that these reports contain not just acts of espionage, because sometimes they just contain this deal information, what kind of equipment American used, what we should exploit or should steal, and so on. But these everyday details, you know, life of American young men and women had so attractive details for these KGB agents that they could not avoid to put this. And it's, for example, one report I still remember when describing how one agent tried to seduce Greek-American girl who worked for exhibition in Kyiv contained more details of what this girl loved to eat, to drink, how she behaved, how she played a music instrument. You know, all these people actually demonstrated that these American guests had certain intellectual abilities, and they attracted these agents not only because they were foreigners, but because they had these intellectual abilities and tastes for new music. They call this jazz music, but obviously it wasn't jazz, but also rock and roll. They call this beat music. And it's interesting how KGB people became involved in exchanging these tapes of forbidden American jazz, obviously rock and roll music, and I assume they still use these tapes for their own personal listening. So these connections was connection not only to discover technological secrets, but also discover civilization, different kind of people living. And I think that to some extent, the opening of Soviet Union and involvement of these KGB agents in this process was also part of this widening of dialogues between the West and Soviet Union. But unfortunately, after 1979, after Afghanistan, Soviets began closing this. As a result, we have escalation of tensions and the end of this discovery. So to some extent, my book is also about this lost opportunity, this lost opportunity to understand each other. And to some extent, what happened today, it's a result of misunderstanding between post-Soviet space and the West.
Yeah, so it looks like on the one hand, the KGB machinery, right, was paying attention to very delicate and very intimate details. But on the other hand, there was, of course, this attempt to limit the exposure to the other. And one of the final parts of your book also covers some information about books that were forbidden in the USSR. So would you just briefly talk about those books which were not allowed in the USSR during the time period that you discussed?
But, you know, actually, many of these books about erotic experience, about sexual life, were circulated in our region, our oval, Cherkasko. I still remember this because I knew about the existence in Vatuzhny, in Zhenirovsky Rayon, Cherkasko Oblast, and in Cherkasy as well. So I just found this proof that it was, again, another KGB operation, because KGB tried to stop dissemination of so-called forbidden books. And some of these books were instructions of sex, how to behave sexually, how to express sexually, how to gratify your sexual desires in sexual acts. And KGB was also shocked when they discovered that party personnel of Cherkasy party newspaper actually disseminated these American books about sexual life, about sexual activities, about sexual forms and techniques. And KGB tried to stop this, but again, it was, I tried to explain this, it was the result of opening of the Soviet Union, mm-hmm. because in the period of détente, Soviets and Americans signed special agreements about the book exchange. And paradoxically, not only book of famous American and British writers, but also books about erotic and sexual techniques. It's not pornography. It's very important, literature which was consumed by all Western people. But it's also officially came to Kyiv through these détente relations of the 70s. And when KGB tried to stop this, it was too late. They were translated into Russian, Ukrainian. They were disseminated everywhere in Soviet Ukraine. The same happened with videotapes. I explained this earlier. So these books became part of KGB operations. And again, KGB failed in this case. So if you analyze actually conclusions of my chapters, you will see that in a of spy games, Soviet KGB succeeded. But in arena of everyday culture consumption, they failed because of ideology and because of economy. Economy didn't work. Mm-hmm. So to some extent, my book, summary of my book, it's about succession of us. Successes of KGB in diplomacy and in foreign relations. I showed how Soviets actually tried to influence American Canadian politicians, and they succeeded this. They even tried to bribe candidate of 1968 presidential campaign in United States. So to some extent, they succeeded. They succeeded in discrediting Ukrainian diaspora as fascist, as nationalistic, as racist, anti-Afro-American, and so on. So they succeeded on this front. But in domestic front, mm-hmm, it was complete mm-hmm. failure. Mm-hmm. People still continue to listen to rock and roll, watch American movies, wear American jeans, and of course, read about sexual techniques and use them in everyday life.
So your book was just published, but I'm sure that you already have your new project. So would you just share a couple of ideas on what you're working right now?
Actually, I collected so many materials, and more important, SBU Archive provided us with digital information about files you ordered. So I have all these digital, especially mm-hmm. by computer. So I decided, so this book was my first attempt mm-hmm. to show major operations covered by these documents. Again, I use the most sexy, the most catchy document. For example, I use documents about Safyanova, double agent who tried to seduce Soviet agents and worked for CIA. I tried to use documents about espionage and role of these exhibits, about hippie and rock and roll and punks, about these erotic books. So what I found, the first, I tried to put this in a book to show everybody, especially people in the West, this richness, wealth of material, which still exists in Kyiv, in SBU archive. Plus, it was my revenge, personal revenge, for people of KGB who did not allow me to use their archives when I wrote my book about Dnipropetrovsk, Rock and Roll Rock City. They did not allow me to go there.
Mm.
So now I have this revenge. So this was my first, probably very awkward, because I put in this book everything from sex to rock and roll, from diplomacy to espionage. So it's the first awkward, probably, but still very substantial attempt to dig in these archives.
Mm-hmm.
Next step will be more detailed and more professional. I will write, I began writing a book, and I have a couple of offers from different British and American publishers. It will be a more scandalous book. It will be called KGB and Western Academia, or How Soviet and Russian Intelligence Try to Influence Slavic Studies in English-Speaking World. I will concentrate on United States, Canada, and United Kingdom, especially London School of Economics, which became infamous for taking money from either Libya or from Russian oligarchs, and using this money for very bad purposes. So I will try to show how, since 1958, from the year of the first exchange, academic exchange between Soviets and Americans, KGB, and then later on, after 1991, Russian FSB, Tyranny Sluba Bezopasnosti, and GRU tried to use and misuse and abuse various Slavic centers in the West, in the English-speaking West, to influence them and to support positive images. Remember, I will consider by the ideology, the major point of ideological approach is creation of positive image of Russia. It's very important. That's why they would use Cannon Institute, they would use Harvard University, Sanders Davis, and Ukrainian Research Institute, for only one reason: to create and maintain and disseminate a positive image, pro-Russian image, of Russian political, economic, and cultural ideological actions. And I finished with 2022 with next step in Russian war against Ukraine, because Russian war against Ukraine started, as you remember, in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
Just next step to show, to demonstrate how now Russian Secret Service, now Russian intelligence, used famous think tanks and various Slavic centers for their operation. It now with one big difference: they have more money from post-Soviet space. They could corrupt members of these centers, Western politicians. And I just give you a sense what kind of, you know, such name as Anne Applebaum.
Mm-hmm.
You know that she had position in the London School of Economics.
Mm-hmm.
She was very dangerous for Russians. Mm-hmm. With her criticism of Putin's politics, despite all her wonderful book, you remember, book about Gulag and so on, and book about famine in Ukraine, on the more. So what happened was she was removed.
Well, I'm really looking forward to your new publication, to your new book. But for now, congratulations again on KGB operations against the USA and Canada in Soviet Union, 1953-1991. And thank you so much for this research that helped us better understand how the KGB operated and even how the Soviet Union operated. At the same time, as you pointed out in this interview, it also sheds light on how Russia operates today. So it's very relevant and very helpful for the present moment as well. And you you mentioned that maybe the book is a little bit awkward, but because it includes so many aspects, but on the other hand, all these multiple aspects also show how much is taken in order to create this positive image. So it's not only about history, it's not only about political development, but it's also about culture. And that's what we talk to today about. We talk about Russian culture and canceling Russian culture and how it is connected with the political moment. So thank you so much, Sergei.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Today I spoke with Sergei Zhuk, author of KGB Operations Against the USA and Canada in Soviet Ukraine, 1953-1991, published by Routledge in 2022. Thank you for listening to New Books in Ukrainian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network.